And I am extremely grouchy this morning. I apologize, but it's like, I can't anymore.
What's wrong? What's going on?
I'm at the point, like this whole Shemitah thing, where I have nothing to eat because I love vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, string, like all this stuff. And at this point, I have nothing left that's not Shemitah. And I, you know, this year is Shemitah, and you're not allowed to eat anything that's grown in Israel.
Whoa.
On the seventh
but
year.
But Shoshana,
I'm
Shoshana.
Really, I'm grouchy.
There are so many options. Meaning, I understand you have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi or your halachic authority, whoever, to decide, are you going to follow the Heta Mechira? There's certain loopholes that are allowed to help the farmers. Or you could have produce that we call Yavul Nachri, right? Something that is grown by Arabs or Christians, somebody who's not Jewish to begin with, where the land is not owned by the Jews. Or you could have produce that's left over from the sixth year, meaning this is a seventh year.
I don't know, and you're saying all these things, but it sounds to me like these are just like excuses. Like, it just, I listen, Shemitah's a doraita, and I live in Eretz Yisrael.
But these are
like
the halachic workarounds. What do you think? You really think the Chazal said, oh, let's just leave everybody to starve? Do you really think that anybody would accept it if the food for their plates was not going to be available to them? There's plenty
not
of...
Not everything in Judaism is fair, and we know that. Like, okay, so you eat fruit. Like, right now, it's fruit you can have because it was grown in the sixth. Okay, so I don't eat broccoli just like
listen,
I don't eat pig. I mean, that's just the way it is to
be Jew. My son would be very happy to divest himself of any vegetable opportunities. But that is not how this works. That is not how Torah works. Torah accommodates the fact that there is a halachic requirement of not working the land, but that doesn't mean you can't eat vegetables. Listen, it's like the same way that we can't own chametz on Pesach. Of course, you can't eat it, but you also can't own it. So we have a loophole. The loophole allows us to sell our chametz. And yeah, then most people buy it back after Pesach, and it's a loophole. And I understand where loopholes kind of feel not comfortable, but they work. Halachically, they're in the canon. They work.
So you're telling me that a complete and total deoraita from God on Sinai can be moved aside or worked around or made to be not exactly the way it's written down so that people don't suffer?
I think that is exactly the point. Exactly so that people don't suffer. If you got rid of all your chametz and you couldn't ever buy it back, for some people, that would be a tremendous hardship. If you couldn't eat vegetables and then fruit during a Shemitah year and after the Shemitah year for the fruit, that would be a tremendous hardship. So halacha and the rabbis worked it out. Meaning they worked it out generations ago to make sure that there are policies in place that can be, in fact, applied to make sure that people are not suffering, that they are not lacking. That doesn't mean there's no sacrifice. There's a little bit of sacrifice, but not hurting.
So what you're saying is that God-given commandments and man-made adjustments are appropriate ways to utilize halacha and live as an Orthodox Jew?
I mean, listen, it always depends. There's rabbis and there's rabbis. People can kind of disregard the system. But built into the system, yes, is not just the capacity. It's a requirement for the rabbis to get involved, for the scholars to get involved, and make sure that halacha is being applied well.
So that we may live by them.
So that we may live by them. V'chai b'hem. The Torah tells us that we should live according to the commandments. V'lo she'amut b'hem. We don't die by them. We live by them. There's always an example of somebody who martyred themselves and it was the right thing to do at that right time. Fine. For the most part, nearly always, certainly in our day and age, v'chai b'hem, that we should live by them.
Well, Anne, obviously, I have been eating vegetables this whole year. And obviously, I can choose from the Heter Mechira, or from those vegetables that are grown outside of the borders of Eretz Yisrael, which can be right near Gaza or underneath Be'er Sheva. And obviously I can eat nochri, and obviously I can eat hydroponically grown in sand. And there are so many options for my broccoli and petrozilia, parsley. And yet, Anne, this whole open was specifically designed, I don't know how many people we actually fooled, but how many specifically designed to highlight something that we recently took on here in Israel.
Welcome back to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm Ann Gordon, here today with
Shoshana Keats-Jaskel.
Believe it or not, we're discussing Agunot. Yep, that's right. As Shoshana just said, we're not sure how many people we fooled here, but the question of loopholes in halacha is a tricky one. I certainly have kind of this intuitive discomfort with the idea of a loophole, and yet, within the context of halacha, Loopholes are very much a part and parcel of the system. We've mentioned two big ones, specifically selling chametz on Pesach, and not everybody does, but it's there and it works. And the loopholes or details by which we manage Shemitah, by which we manage Shemitah, including a heter mechira, which is a loophole, but also other solutions that don't even require the same finagling that a loophole might. There are other ones throughout history. One of the most famous ones is Hillel from Hillel and Shammai, right, from the Mishnah. Prizbol is a document that enables people who have lent money, and people who would lend money, often that would happen in great quantities. We're not talking about, you know, $5 for a snack. They would then be able to go continue to collect on a loan even after the halacha says the loans are canceled, specifically every 7 years. It's connected to Shemitah, but Hillel's decree of a Prizbol is one of the most famous loopholes, and it's a little controversial, and yet nobody really contravenes it. Everybody accepts that it works, that the loophole itself, that the application of a means of making sure that people will continue to lend money because they're not going to be afraid that the cancellation of that loan will come too soon. Hillel made sure that people would still lend money because they can continue to expect to collect on the loan, which does seem to be exactly the opposite of what the Torah intends.
So it's interesting to me, Anne. It seems from what you're saying that when a solution was found to a very clear isur, something you're not allowed to do in the Torah, there was basically an acknowledgement that there was a crisis or a problem that needed to be solved, right? Like when you say like these various things, what do they have in common? For me as an observer, it would be they decided that there had to be a solution and they found one. You can tell me more technically, halachically, if there's anything else in common. But for me, that's what I see as the layperson.
I think that another factor here is what I would call the need of the community at large. Not that that's necessarily in the words of any one of these decrees, but it's not because a person doesn't like, I don't like this prohibition, so let's find a workaround, right? Meaning there are plenty of prohibitions that people find inconvenient, that individuals find inconvenient for their personal lives. I imagine that any number of people, for all that we love and glorify Shabbat, I'm sure there are plenty of people who, at least on occasion, find the limitations of Shabbat to be restrictive in a way that is uncomfortable. And we do have certain accommodations for Shabbat, like ways to do things that make it okay on Shabbat. But it's not the same thing as saying, let's just do away with the Doraita of Shabbat, the Torah commandments of Shabbat, or, I don't know, adultery. Maybe people would like to commit adultery, but nobody says, here's a workaround, right?
Here's like, a way to do it.
it's prohibited and it's prohibited and that's that. But that's an individual level of an individual's desire to do something that violates halacha. And the answer is, yes, people do violate halacha, but too bad for you. Halacha is not going to accommodate that. When we're talking about the societal ill that would have happened if all the lenders, the money lenders, I don't mean this in a bad way, not usury, just money lending, right? If everybody closed up shop and then people couldn't borrow because there would be nobody to lend, that would have caused havoc in the community at large. Money lending is part of the way business functions. We all know how this is part of the society. Likewise, the Heta Mechira of Shemitah was put into place really as Jews came back to Israel, not just with the state of Israel, you know, 50 years before that, whatever. It was designed to ensure that the farmers themselves who were growing produce in the land of Israel would have the means to continue to function in their livelihood. That's not one person whom you could say, you know what, don't be a farmer, go be a shopkeeper, go be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant. It doesn't matter. You can do something else than farm the land. That also sounds kind of really weird in the face of the Torah and farming the land. But the point is, there was a whole class of farmers. It's not just one person. So now we're talking about a societal need. And I think that that is part of where the sages in the early years and the rabbis in the later years, meaning more local rabbis, you know, would figure out how can we make sure that we treat halacha with respect, we uphold halacha by, frankly, sometimes even undermining it. But because it comes as a decree from the rabbis who are, again, treating halacha with respect, it works. The halacha gets upheld. We have a new way of handling that same detail of halacha.
We are talking, obviously, for our purposes, about women who are chained in marriage. Halachically speaking, in order to leave a marriage without being a widow, the man has to give the get. That's, you know, written in the Torah. The man gives the get, whether that's, you know, a description or whether that's the only way it could be. It has been defined halachically as it has to be that way. And yet, Anne, even in the Mishnah and Gemara, there are ways that marriages have been ended in the past. Obviously, you know, various circumstances, blah, blah, blah. We're not going into the halacha. But the point is that when there was a need, there were solutions found. So I was sitting in the offices of Yad Le'Isha, which is a wonderful organization that represents Agunot under the auspices of Or Torah Stone Network of Institutions. And I was sitting with Hila, who's our deputy director of Chochmat Nashim, and Penina Omer, who is the director of Yad Le'Isha. And we were talking about the fact that there are elections coming up for the Dayanim. They are the ones who make the decisions when a couple comes into a courtroom to get divorced. They can order the man to give the get. They can order sanctions. They can suggest compromises, whatever it is. They are the ones in control in the courtroom, and that really matters.
And just to clarify, the Beit Din of Dayanim, meaning when judges sit, that's what they are. These are judges. They will nearly always be three at a time. Not everything has to be a unanimous vote, but it has to be two against one, right? Meaning that's the idea of there being an odd number of people. And part of the reason who are the judges makes a difference, because not every judge will see the case exactly the same way. If all the judges would see the cases the exact same way, there would be just one judge for every case. There would be no need to have three and a reasonable meeting of the minds. So who the judges are and how they regard anything that comes their way becomes of great significance.
Tremendously. I'll get to that in a second. So we were sitting and talking about, you know, how do we get the right men elected to these positions? Men who see women as people, men who understand the importance of
women as people?
Sorry. Yes, women
I'm
as people.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
I know, you know, it sounds like crazy, but that's how we feel. Like at this point, you know, someone's deserving of being able to be free if she wants to be free. And someone who unfortunately maybe has suffered tremendous abuse. And there's a lot of things that go into being a Dayan that doesn't even come close to halacha, right? Like there's so much there before we even touch halacha. But because we happen to be in Shemitah year, we were sitting and talking, and it was a very frustrating conversation, as it often is. And Hila says to me, "Ugh, if only we were parsley." And I looked at her and I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "What do you mean? Do you know how many different types of parsley I can buy? Do you know how many options I have if I go to the store?"
And during the Shemitah year.
During Shemitah. And I was just kind of dumbstruck. And I was like, oh my God, that is such a powerful way of looking at this. Like, if only I was a vegetable, I'd have more options than a woman chained in marriage. And I just felt like every time I say it, it really hits me in the whatever this is, my heart. Anyway, so we were talking about
Before you get to the big reveal that we're getting to here, I just want to note, because you said something important, I think, and I think it goes back even to Shemitah, right? Not everything handling Shemitah, every solution of Shemitah, not everything is a loophole. Not everything is a rabbinic decree that seems to turn Shemitah on its head. Some of the solutions to Shemitah are simply, you know, with the grace of refrigeration and freezers, we can save produce. With transport, I understand transport and supply lines are a little bit iffy right now, but still, like there are other options of how we can handle this. And you've been saying that, I've heard you talk about this, I don't know, I couldn't count the number of times, how many potential solutions there are for a situation of Mesurev Get, of Get refusal, where, for example, to what extent, and I've seen this done in the States, but perhaps it's less done here, to what extent are the Dayanim saying, let's check into the witnesses. Let's see if there was something in the marriage to begin with that invalidated this marriage to begin with. Meaning before you even jump to more extreme kinds of decrees on the parts of Dayanim. I understand that there are other tools there as well. I'm just saying that there's so many pieces of the puzzle that I feel like when there's a marriage that is falling apart, there are very many ways for those who dig deep enough, forgive me, but who care about digging deep enough, who take the time to dig deep enough, then sometimes there's enough not working that goes back to the beginning that the Kiddushin or the Nisuin to begin with did not necessarily hold true for the obligation of get. And from many of the Beit Din stories that I have heard, that's not the first thing that they do, right? The first thing that often happens is that a couple, even in a situation of abuse, is sent home for what they call, what we call shalom bayit, that they should try to work things out. And I'm all for people trying to work things out. I believe in marriage. I even believe in a strong marriage and a strong kiddushin. And yet, I think we care about the dayanim being the people who will, there you go, treat the women as people and make sure that their interests are upheld in the court.
Right. So you actually, it's interesting, and you touched on this whole idea of like going and seeing if maybe the marriage was invalid, but like what you say as that's not even a big deal. It's a massive deal in the Beit Din, and they do not do that, mamash not right away, or even third, fourth, or sixth. I mean, so this is what I've been saying for a really long time. Like, yes, there are halachic solutions, but honestly, I believe, and this is based on my, you know, activism and speaking to other people, I think 90% of get refusal could be avoided and like stopped before it happens if you don't allow extortion. Right? If the Beit Din didn't say, okay, well, what do you want in exchange for the get? Which just allows...
What'll you give me for this halachic document that's d'oraita?
It's just an endless source, because if you feel that you can get something or that you have the right to demand something, so you're opening this massive Pandora's box. If that is closed, if the Beit Din would just say, we are going to handle the get, not rechush, possessions, not, you know, inheritance or anything like that.
Or child support. We're handling
the get or child support. We're going to handle just the get right now. That's it. You can't play. There's no gun on the table, or, you know, metaphorically.
Loaded gun.
Loaded gun, thank you. And so before we even were to get to the halachic solutions and think of women as parsley, we really could simply just say, this is a court where we amicably, as best as possible, enable the dissolution of a marriage without extortion, without fighting, without he said, she said. First of all, so much more respectful of the couple and of Jewish marriage to begin with. In my mind, it's funny, people argue about having a strong marriage, but I think having get refusal and agunot weakens Jewish marriage. I know for me as a Jewish mother, and I said this 2 weeks ago, last week, I don't remember when it was, on the news, I am a Jewish mother, a religious Jewish mother, and I am afraid.
Of daughters and sons,
thank God. And I am afraid to walk my daughters down the aisle because I won't be doing it with 100% joy. There will be a fear that I have, God forbid. And that's not okay. That's not what it should be.
I want to note your point here about if extortion were not on the table, if there was no such possibility, I would say that I would think that would even obviate the other best solution at hand, let's say, of prenups. Prenuptial agreements that are not about a couple's resources in terms of finance. The prenups are there to make sure, or to deter, I guess that's the best word, to deter anybody from holding a get hostage over the other, both men and women. So
correct.
I think that that would be, I agree with you. I think that this extortion possibility, and sometimes I've heard of lawyers advocating to their clients, you know, oh, yes, hold out on the visitation, like even to the moms, right? Mm-hmm. Hold out on the visitation and then he'll give you, you know, more. Don't accept your get now because you can manipulate the situation to your advantage. And we obviously think that's very bad. I want to come back to something you said also, and I think that this is really where we've been trying to get to, which is, so how do we convince the dayanim who are soon to be appointed, and we don't know who's going to be elected or appointed, really, it's not exactly street talk who's going to be the dayanim on the Beit Din. How do we make sure that anybody who comes to the Beit Din going forward is aware of these issues in a way that they can handle the cases of get refusal that come before them, not just in a dignified way, but in a way that solves the issue.
So sometimes, Anne, the only way you can show someone the absurdity of a situation is through satire, like taking it
satire.
Taking it to an extreme where you're just like, what is going on? And then it's like the big reveal of like, whoa, wait a minute.
Nafal Asimon, as they say, like the penny drop.
Yeah, like whoa, that's what we're talking about. And also sometimes you have to remember that you have to speak in a language that people can hear and understand. Otherwise, all your good points are going to be in the air. So that's why we put out this Alon Shabbat 2 weeks ago, and last week on Shabbat, two different rounds. We published, printed, and distributed a very satiric. And if you don't speak Hebrew, it's a little bit of a chaval because you'll miss all of the wordplay and the nuances, but we are having an English translation, so you could at least enjoy it to a certain extent. Called
maybe like the kind of thing that you find in shul. Like there's correct. There's a counter or something of a whole bunch of different ones. Maybe our English listeners will know of Torah Tidbits is one of the very famous ones, but there's a whole lot everywhere. I haven't been in shul since Corona began, so
I don't know
anything, but I'm not seeing this anywhere. But yes, I understand exactly what you're talking about. And they are all the rage in Israel. They're a huge thing. People take them to read both, unfortunately, during davening, but also home at their leisure, meaning and the whole family then can read.
Yes. So we created a parsha sheet called Agunat HaShabbat, which is already a play on words of Oneg Shabbat. And the entire sheet is very satiric.
Because Aguna and Oneg. I get it. That's cute.
Thank you. For Parshat Vatishev, which obviously doesn't exist.
Because the Parsha was Vayeshev, Vateshev. Yes. That's very cute, Shoshana. This is very clever.
It's actually phenomenal. I would not have been able to do this myself. Clearly, we had help. But I know that we succeeded, first of all, in raising hackles and in raising awareness, because I got messages from people and we were on the news, right? So the radio was interested. Ynet did a whole big piece. They interviewed us, and also Channel 14 News, which is quite a right-wing news channel, which is really good for who we're trying to target. Because as you say, Anne, like, how do you get to the people who are making these decisions? And in Israel, everything is about the news. So in order to make a big splash, this very satiric, that no one's ever done anything like this before, by the way, the regular Agunah organizations that do amazing work were just like, this is phenomenal. And everything we do generally is coordinated to a certain extent with other people because we do collaborate. We do
and
want to make sure
Chochmat
that...
And it's part of the Chochmat Nashim raison d'etre. We've always collaborated. I want to just note, you know, our podcast is in English. I don't know how many native Hebrew speakers are listening now, but this is Chochmat Nashim reaching out into Hebrew in a really different kind of way. I appreciate that you say you had help. I can learn in Hebrew. I don't think I could create satire in Hebrew.
Yeah. The language does allow for so much more than English does with the way that you can play with the nuance of the words. It's phenomenal. So I suggest reading it with a Hebrew speaker if you can, but we will get an English version to you. Point being, we distributed tens of thousands of these all across the country. We really invested in this so that the awareness was raised. The language was used to hit people that Chochmat Nashim would never normally be able to get to. Okay. And yes, we were on the news. Why? Because there's a government committee that is susceptible to pressure. Meaning, we could say to Matan Kahana, who's the Minister of Religious Affairs, the two chief rabbis, there's a whole committee and we know exactly who they are, who will be making the decisions. We need them to know that we want, and this is exactly what I said when I got my chance in Hebrew, God help me, I said on the news, we don't have a halachic problem. We have a human problem, and we need the right humans on the bench. And that way of removing, see what happens is people are like, but halacha, there's nothing you can do. And when you say, put halacha on the side for 1 second, there's so much you can do before you get there. That's what we need to change. And I saw that actually one of the hosts looked at me and he goes, but what do the Dayanim have to do with it? And I'm like, what?
Like, because Shoshana, this is the thing. If you are lucky enough to have never needed a Beit Din for divorce,
correct,
then how would you know what the procedure is? And how would you know how contingent things might be on a given individual's personality? I would like to say, I hope, we know this is not true, but I hope that every Dayan is as upright and above board as can possibly be. There are all kinds of rules, both in halacha and common sense, about, you know, the regulations of what it takes to be a Dayan and to avoid things like bribery and you know, again, manipulation, things like that. But they're also still people and they come with their own perspectives. And so you can take a narrower view of the law or a broader view of the law. Like, there's a great deal of wiggle room within the upright, honorable judging system.
Look, I can give you something very simple. And then I'm happy to, you know, send this PDF to anyone who wants to see it. Please reach out. Like this. A couple comes, someone's refusing. You say, sorry, we can't extort. We don't do that here. And they're still refusing. Then you look at them and say, look, you have 6 months to either come to a compromise or we're ordering the chiyuv get one way or the other, whether it's the man or the woman. If that chiyuv, that obligation to give or receive the get, is known that it's coming in 6 months, then you're not going to have people waiting 14 or 18 years. Someone I know just texted
14
me
or 18 years. Think
years,
about
years.
What you've just said.
Years.
I understand.
No, no, I know.
I understand. But I feel like even for all the activism and all the talking that we do about agunot, I think that the scope of what it means to have one's hands tied, for an aguna to have her hands tied, or for a man whose wife refuses to get, I understand that there's some loopholes, again, another loophole, that can allow him to remarry, but it's still not so simple. And I think that this is an important point. This is why this aguna issue is at the societal level and not at the individual who wants to go do something different, right? That this is why when we bring it into the context of chametz and what does it mean for a baker, an ownership for the lack of business, let's say, or the farmers in Shemitah or the lenders in the time of Hillel. And I'm not saying that we need a decree because we're not in a halachic world to make decrees now, but to recognize that what is going on here is, at a societal level, a complication for all of us. I agree with you. I think it is an impediment to Jewish marriage, to the same strong Jewish marriage that I believe in. If people feel that it functions as a prison or a risk of a prison, then what is that doing? I don't believe that's what Kiddushin is supposed to be.
I 100% agree with you, Anne. And obviously, thank you for bringing that right back to the beginning for me, because I will talk all day. What do you guys think? And how do you think we as the community, where can you put your pressure points, whether it's a rabbi, whether it's signing a post up yourself, speaking about it in your community? I would love to hear from you guys if you have any further ideas or if you want help from us to get it done. And if you want a PDF, let us know. Chochmat Nashim on social. C-H-O-C-H-M-A-T-N-A-S-H-I-M.
Can you hear us now?